This week's podcast is brought to you by Alluring Africa, which is a Florida-based boutique African tour operator founded by my friend Sunit Sangrachka. Sunit was born and raised in Africa, growing up in a family that started one of the first photographic companies in Kenya. Sunit and his team specialize in conservation-based safaris to Africa's exclusive wilderness areas that support its wildlife and communities. Alluring Africa goes beyond the prepackaged itineraries you see online because they understand the only way to organize the best experience for you is to have an intimate understanding of what you care about. Give them a call on 800-510-6059 or go to their website www.alluringafrica.com, and that's spelled A-L-L-U-R-I-N-G-A-F-R-I-C-A. Hey, Lofty, you there?
How are you?
I'm pretty cool, man. And you?
Good. Let me make sure I'm recording here. I have it okay. On. Yeah, I am recording. I have an automatic recording happening because I've missed a few with my group, and it was always nicer to have an audio after the fact. So we are recording. And like I said, it converts, and then it gets saved to me. So I can send it to you via WeTransfer or Google Drive. But if there's any issue, like I said, my girl will be here tomorrow, Paige, and I will have her make sure that if I don't get it to you tonight on my own, then we'll sort it out for you tomorrow.
That's fantastic. Thanks. It's awesome to have a girl, Paige, doing the background stuff for you. I've got me, myself, and I in our battle.
Yes, you need people. One must have people.
Yeah. Well, you have people coming in. I'm not allowed to see anybody. We've been in lockdown for 3 months, 4 months.
I know. Well, I'm in lockdown. Yeah. Where are you? You're in Virginia?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm in lockdown. I actually have had, I have a lot of interns that I work with, and we've been virtual the entire time. And just about 2 weeks ago, three of them, I meet with virtually, or I have a social distance meeting on my back patio. And then I have a co-working space we went to yesterday for the first time. So it's been all virtual until recently.
Well, that sounds pretty much like us. We do our virtual meetings as well on the lawn outside, 6 feet apart. Bring your own wine, bring your own snack, share the conversation.
I like that.
Nice. Yeah, it works well.
Yeah. So how are you faring in all this?
It depends. It depends on which aspect of my life you're looking at. But by and large, I would say faring very well. It's been, for me, particularly fabulous to have both of my sons back at home. The eldest son is 23 and should really be up at university doing his master's, but he's been sent back. And the youngest, who's 21, almost about to finish his university career, has been sent home too. So we've had these two we've been empty nesters, and the nest's been repopulated with these two guys being back, which has been good fun. We've achieved quite a lot. Obviously I'm still working, and that's not faring too well. Obviously income is a little slow. The job is as big as it ever was. In fact, I'm finding myself probably working longer hours than I've ever done before, just trying to keep everybody that I represent relevant in the face of the trade. Which has been quite tough, particularly as the trade itself is depressed. The companies that we normally call on and liaise with on a regular basis have become a lot smaller than they used to be, so less people to talk to. So yeah, it's been quite a challenging time. So in that respect, things have been a bit tricky.
Yeah.
And you've just basically been getting Women's Adventure Travels launched and flying, and just as you were about to, I suppose had just taken off, somebody came along and clipped your wings. How do you feel about all that right now?
You know, if I really went down that hole, it would be a sad one and a not very good one. I was really just starting to get traction with the group trips. And even bigger than the group trips, I was getting a lot of interest on custom travel. So a lot of people are like, hey, I like what you're doing. Can you organize this for my husband and I, or for our family? Or there's a couple of couples and a group of 10 women. And so that was like a surprise. I didn't really imagine that. And it really started to take off at the first of the year. So, and it looked like it was going in a great direction. So yeah, it was a definite clip pretty much out of the gate with all this. And I think what saved me is actually working with all these interns. I have not stopped since that. I've been working as hard, if not harder.
Yeah.
I was asked to be the entrepreneur in residence at a university nearby.
Yeah.
And the agreement was, they said, we just need you to have one student from the university. And so I actually had 5 interns from the university, but then I had 14 in total. So I had 9 from, you know, other schools, and they gave me a 2-story house, and I had, you know, big conference rooms, and we had this great run of the house, and I would work in one room and they would be in the other. And I just really kind of took it full on and thought, well, I have this house and this time. And I got, you know, video people, videographers, video editors, photo editor, the full thing, graphics, arts, like a full team. But I worked really hard at training them and sharing a lot of my like multimedia and entertainment. And so I had this really robust team, and we did great work, and they all got along like crazy. And then when we were broken up in the middle of it, my way to kind of keep the morale going, mainly for the graduates, because some were out of school, some were from another school, was that I created a virtual speaker series and brought in people from all different walks of my life, entertainment, media, what have you. And so each week we had a pretty great, you know, happening from LA, from New York, different speakers that shared their stories. And we kept this whole thing going via Zoom, and then they loved it. They were so inspired. And so the girl I mentioned to you, Paige, we're actually doing a documentary called The Quarantine Routine about this, the kind of life that we, you know, from this kind of hodgepodge of people from all over, and the speaker and the series. And it was great. It was a really tight group, and it remained tight throughout. And most of the kids wanted to continue in the summer. So I just thought, well, it's a window of time. You know, people are here and people are open to doing this. So we put a post up on Indeed for interns and got about 800 people applied. And so I took on about 15 more. So we had probably 25 interns this summer. And I continued your series, and I've trained, like, it's been a lot of work, as you can imagine, training 25 people. But it's been awesome. And I have over 30 videos good to go. And so we look quiet on the outside, but I've been creating all kinds of graphics and logos, and, you know, we have a whole social media campaign, and we're launching a podcast. And so Women's Adventure Travels reflects my past, which is travel, entertainment, and media. And I've been working really hard on the entertainment and media since this happened.
Man, you cross so many little different, well, it's not little, you cross so many different disciplines. I'm intrigued by this whole internship program. So were these business students that ended up working with you, or were they just from the various disciplines that you're involved in?
They were, a lot of them were like multimedia. So like film students, English, like I have an amazing writer. This summer, the students are from NYU, Cornell, like all over Ohio State. I have someone from Spain. So the reach went a lot wider for the summer. So yeah, we have English majors for, you know, the writers. We have marketing and PR, which has worked in the marketing PR, obviously, social media side. And then we have multimedia or film majors, which have worked on the you know, video editing side. And then artists, right? There's a great art school here called PCAD, Pennsylvania College of Art and Design. And I had 2 students from there, and then virtually another artist. So they're really, it's pretty much the full scope of what you would have if I was going to have this great huge team. And so it's been amazing. I mean, like I said, it's a lot of work to like people just show up and they're ready to go, because you have to train them, and then you have to show them your way and how you do things. And then you get people working together as a team. So it's a lot. And a couple of times I'm like, I took off way more than I can chew, and I probably should have done this. But I think it's what's kept my morale up. It's been a lot of fun, and I love working in a team, and I love collaborating and being creative. And so, and they're great. I mean, I think I just attract the right people with, you know, this business. It kind of attracts people that are travelers, and but yet want a little bit more of a passion or purpose behind it, or they're into entertainment or women. And so yeah, It's been great.
So, Corinne, I'm just, again, a little bit more curiosity from my side. With all these people coming in and working under your leadership, are you then giving them credits towards the degree or their diplomas, whatever they're studying towards? Are you being guided by the universities in terms of the curriculum and what you need to be schooling them on? Or is it just hard work for them getting some experience so that they can step out into the big wide world when COVID's gone and say, I have this experience under my belt working for Corinne Loftus and Women's Adventure Travels?
It's all of the above. So five students that were there for credit from the university. So the university, now it's my third, because I worked with them last summer and then in the fall. So it's my third semester, are pretty much hands off. And I have to fill out paperwork and then about what the role is. And then midway we do an evaluation. And then at the end, I talk with the professor and also do a final evaluation. But other than that, they're pretty hands off. There's a certain amount of hours and what have you. And then some people are there strictly for what you said. They're there for the experience. They want to build up their portfolio, create video or, you know, art. They have this great bit of work, professional work that they can then show because, you know, in order to get a job today, they need professional experience. So the internship is good for that. And then some of them have continued. I've brought them on. So I do work with some people part-time that I then pay. So it's a mix.
Oh, that's fantastic. You know, so many people have sat on their hands during this COVID lockdown, sort of desperately trying to figure out what to do with themselves and not finding much direction. I'm just fascinated that you've been able to embrace all of this in a relatively short period of time and go screaming ahead successfully. But I suppose that's in your nature, right? I mean, when I remember meeting you in Ireland for the first time, we were traveling with that adventure travel show. And what struck me about you right off the bat was you have this wonderful sense of humor. And so clearly your charisma and openness and your fun-seeking side has attracted people that want to be associated with you and work under you. I'm sure that's got to be part of the recipe.
Yeah, I mean, I do think I'm fun and I make this fun. And, you know, I've always worked, you know, people think entertainment or even travel, anything that is deemed fun, travel, entertainment or media looks sexy and fun, but it's a lot of hard work. So I also, no matter who I'm working with, whoever's creative, I constantly sell the business side as well. Like you can't just sit around and rub your belly all day and be creative. Like, so I'm constantly marrying. I mean, I studied marketing in school, but I've had a creative career my whole life that I also really, really sell to them the idea of all the business and the marketing. And I call it Zoom around the room. I have all the different facets work together. And even if you aren't on a particular project, you see how you might create this part, like all the different spokes of the wheel and how it all rolls together. And so I feel proud of what I've done because I do feel like they leave with a better understanding of how all this works, that you're not in a bubble and how to create and collaborate and they love it. I love to learn. So I think my passion for learning comes across. Like I'm learning the whole time. They're learning. We're excited. We love it. It's creative, but it's hard work. Like I do expect people to work hard because I work hard.
Yeah, well, that's it. Lead from the front. I love your phrase, zoom around the room. That's almost Freudian in this time of the year where we all have, I think, mostly existed on this newfound website. I don't even think they were prepared for the volume of traffic that they were going to get from March onwards.
Yeah, I know. It's been great. We do mini niche Zooms, like different categories we Zoom, and then we do the big ones. And so, yeah, it's, I have to say, I was pleasantly surprised and I've brought in, you know, like I said, great friends of mine from all LA and New York, largely from like entertainment and media and some travel, but more so people that are working in marketing or PR or on a TV show or stylist in Hollywood, but it's about branding and marketing and how it all interconnects. And so it's been great to share friends with new friends. And, you know, as isolating as this is, it is nice to still have that touchstone.
It certainly is. And before I go on any further asking you questions, talking marketing, what is your preferred website that people should look to find out more information about you if I were to run a little promo piece during the podcast? In fact, consider this the promo piece. So if you want to find out more about Karen, you can find her on this website.
Women's Adventure Travels.
There we go. And now you like me, have done a podcast. I read when I started venturing into this world of podcasting, and I'll tell you a little bit about my motivation just now. I read somewhere that you can only consider yourself a podcaster if you surpass 7 episodes. And I don't know what or why 7 is the magic number. Then you have no right to be a podcaster or call yourself a podcaster. I think I've managed 13 or 14.
Wow.
One podcast was a 4-part series on Gorongosa in Mozambique, which is a fascinating tale and a really interesting story. How are you progressing and where do we find your podcast?
Well, it's in the works. So I have 2 that are coming out. One is called Say What What? Like my name is Women's Adventure Travels, WAT. So it's Say What What? Actually interviewing women from all over the world. So it is women in South Africa and Zambia and India and kind of really top people that are, you know, pushing the envelope and reflecting a lot what the business is about, which is community empowerment story, you know, women owned and operated businesses or women really defying the odds locally or globally. So pretty, you know, incredible women. And then the other one is a little bit more of a reflection of my more entertainment background, and that's called Lofty Talk. And the subtitle is Comedy, Conversation, and Culture So Hot, It Not Only Pops, It Explodes. So it's similar to what I did, like with my guests, bringing in a lot of my friends from all over and kind of BSing and us talking and how I know them from all these different walks of life. But they're all super interesting and prominent and, you know, killing it in their respective careers and areas. And they're also very important in different ways. You know, whether it's, you know, a women's issue or, you know, interracial marriage or, you know, Black Lives Matter or, you know, LGBTQ or what have you. So a lot of people really pushing the envelope in many ways. And then, so it's fun and us talking ourselves. And then we go into more of a deeper conversation about their work and the resonance and relevance and what have you.
Once you've run your podcast, you've created it, you've had your conversation and everything's ready to go, how are you finding your audience? Are these just people who've been following you through your social media platforms? Or are you actively, because of your subject matter, attracting a different set of people, potentially people who are going to travel with you in the future?
Well, it hasn't happened yet. So I hope, you know, I'm still putting it all together. So all the guests and everything. So I have all that, but I have not recorded yet. So you're 14 plus ahead of me. So I can probably circle back to you. But I imagine it's like everything else. It is, you know, it's not build it and they will come. Build it and then scream really loud and push and shove them in the direction that they come. So, you know, in today's world, there's so much noise in every platform or medium that you have to hustle, you know, so I will be doing a lot of that.
Okay. Well, that's probably where I'm not too effective because I have a travel audience that seems to be growing around the world, which is quite fantastic and not what I had expected. But it is the travel industry, I suppose, and we networked and connected from one end of the globe to the other. So yeah, it's been somewhat of a success there. But in terms of my audience, I mean, I know you, Women's Adventure Travels is going to be leading groups and taking people around the world. And I want to expose a little bit more about what you're doing. But before we do that, I wanted to share with my audience who you are. And in sort of, I suppose, getting my questions together to try and figure out how do I extract Karen Loftus from Lofty Women's African Travels over a podcast. I realized it was a damn challenging, it was, well, the big question was a challenging one because you've walked so many different walks and pavements and lived different, I don't want to say lifestyles, but I suppose it could be lifestyles. You've occupied all sorts of fascinating niches. And I think the one that kind of intrigues me possibly the most is your history as a stand-up comedian. To me, that perhaps it's because it's probably one of the scariest things I could ever think of doing. And so I have this incredible respect for people who can stand up in front of an audience and make them laugh. When did you know you had a knack for comedy and getting people to smile?
I come from a crazy Irish family and a very funny one. So my dad was a raconteur and, you know, bon vivant, large and in charge, come into a room, take over, big little guy, huge personality, and could weave a yarn like nobody else's business. He would just captivate a room, tell a great story, was funny as hell, unapologetic, and just kind of really set the tone for all of us. So we, in our family, there's four kids, we're all pretty good storytellers and you know, everybody's fun and funny and big. And so it really was a surprise in a way that, you know, when some of my cousins were like, what, you're a comedian? Like they thought my twin brother would be a comedian or something. But I'd been performing and writing since I was five. I mean, I was writing things down and I'd go to my cousin's house and set up a tent and a thing in the backyard and recruit cousins. And I was always directing a show and then going door to door like a producer and getting money in advance from neighbors. And so, I mean, the performing was always there, but it wasn't until high school, I think, when I went to an all-girls high school. And I think that's where I always say my egg cracked. And who I've been there is who I've been since, where I think I just found my voice and got, you know, really comfortable and was definitely silly and kind of have followed suit. So my high school and college friends were like, oh, yeah, I get it. I totally see it. But, you know. I didn't intend to do this because I come from a pretty serious family on the other side where everyone's very into business and you make money and you get a big job. And so it was not a welcome thing in my family that I, you know, graduated college and moved to New York to become an actress was, you know, not shined upon. Uh-huh. I started as an actor in New York, kind of a crazy background. I was, working in college, I was a private trainer and aerobics instructor. And that happened. I was waiting tables at some restaurant in Maryland. I went to University of Maryland. And a guy came in and they were about to open this big women's fitness chain. And I said, oh yeah, I teach aerobics, which I didn't, but for some reason I felt the need to say it. And they're like, oh no, we're totally staffed. Like we can't. And then they liked me and they're like, look, we're gonna just figure out, just come tomorrow. We're fully staffed and we're gonna sort it out. So the male and female that owned the studio, the chain, it was like at the height of the whole fitness thing. She was Lillian Litton, which was this big blue blood, New York, you know, old money. And then her partner was this guy, Lou Resigue, who was a big Broadway star. And then the boyfriend and girlfriend, they were about in their 30s at the time. To me, they were like so old. They ran the clubs. So the money and the power were that other couple, but the other two and the guy kind of took me under his wing, and he was a cabaret singer, dancer, big personality type thing. So I ended up getting a job, taught aerobics, ended up becoming an aerobics celebrity. I was like Miss DC Aerobics, Baltimore's best aerobic athlete. I created this aerobic dance troupe. I designed costumes. I performed with like the Chippendale dancers, DC, and won all these competitions, and I did all the ads for the brand, and Miss Maryland did the commercials. We were the blonde and the brunette, and I managed the place. I was head of sales. Like I was just a whiz ball. And then a studio in DC, which had all the politicos at the time, all the powerhouses on the Hill, recruited me and said, we want you to come teach here. So I ended up going down to DC, and I had, you know, super high-end clients, you know, top people, heads of education, heads of all the departments, like everyone you see on TV today were my clients. Like, and because of that,
hey, just hold on a second there. I don't see many people on TV today. There's just one guy who shows up on every show every single day. I hope he wasn't the client of yours back then.
So those types, like on MSNBC, CNN, you know, I'm like, oh my God, they would so be my clients today. But through that, one of a woman who was in DC moved to New York and she sold me, which I don't know if this happens today. She sold me clients, like, and one of my clients was the editor-in-chief of Paris Vogue, who moved to New York, who was the travel editor of Vogue, funny enough, and the longest tenured employee of the magazine. So super high-end people. I moved to New York out of school, you know, as an aerobics instructor, told my parents, I'm going to New York, but I'm not going into business. I'm actually going to teach aerobics and become an actress. And they were like, my mom was like ready to throw herself in traffic. To New York and had great money and great clients. And it was through my meeting that couple and that group that they said to me, you're an actress, you're a natural, you need to go to New York and we're going to help you. So had I not been waiting tables, paying my way through school as I did and met that group that night, I would have never taken that left turn, met them. I didn't know anyone in entertainment, but they hooked me up with Miss Marilyn and the two of us moved to New York and were roommates and fast friends. And I started studying acting and it was through that I kind of ended up in the whole entertainment thing. So
that's absolutely brilliant. Now I'm curious again.
Stand up.
yeah. No, we'll come back to the stand up. I as a youngster played a lot of rugby and the rugby club was a sort of a fairly testosterone filled place. And so boys were boys and men were tough and we beat each other up on the rugby field and we came off bloody and bruised. And when we trained, we did it with big rocks and bricks and heavy bits of steel. And we ran hard and we sweated a lot. So for us rugby playing types to go into a choreographed aerobics class was just the most unusual thing, if not socially completely wrong.
Yeah.
And so one day a mate of mine and I went into an aerobics class and we ended up looking like a retied pretzel before it's baked, completely twisted and certainly nowhere near on the beat. How do you just waltz in and take an aerobics class? I mean, these are finely choreographed exercise routines that require you not only to keep your breath, but also keep step and get people to do all sorts of challenging exercises. Did you have experience in that field before? Was it just something that you were able to draw out of your Irish DNA and do?
I always was a pretty good dancer. I was a gymnast. So moving to music and routines, you know, I competed when I was young as a gymnast. So that I took to quite well, but I just really did take to it. But when they recruited me in DC, I was like, whoa, I'm out of my league here. Every single person at the DC studio was a prima ballerina, like hardcore, serious, been a ballerina since they were little, like top, unbelievable shape. And it was almost the pre-core zone where everyone was flailing around in aerobics. But this studio was called Power Play. It was right by Washington, right by Champions. Remember Champions, the restaurant in DC, down in Georgia?
I don't think I'd moved to America by the time Champions was there.
Okay. So it was right there, I think it was Washington and M, about a block away. So it was like, you know, really buzzing place. But they were doing basically ballerina, like hardcore. We did aerobics with weights. So everybody was ripped and in crazy great shape. But they also were amazing, like form that no one was doing at the time. It was core in essence. It was like Lottie Burke, Pilates type style. So because of that, people were in insane shape and you had to audition at the studio to get between level 1 to 2 to 3. So Deborah Seke, for instance, was one of my clients and she started the Golden Door. If you know, you're a travel person, I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Yes.
There were like top people in politics, in business, in fitness. And the teachers were unbelievable. So I was the only person that didn't come from an actual dance background, but took to it, you know, very well and I was a really good dancer. And then when I moved to New York, I was kind of, my reputation preceded me. So when I got there, my first day I had to go up and audition at the biggest club and the biggest studio at the time. And I got hired on the spot. And then I moved, you know, here I am, this young 22-year-old, like New York City, like I'm teaching on Broadway, you know, 72nd Street. And I'm walking in, it's packed, and there's Step Studio, the dance studio. It was like the second floor, we were in the third floor. And I'm walking through, I'm like, God, what's going on? Is there an audition? Like, I was like, oh my God, I'm in New York, this is just so cool. And it was a line all the way down the stairs and out the block. And it was for my class because they had said, you know, who I was and I was coming to town and like James Taylor is in my first class. And, you know, I had a lot of Laurie Singer and I had Bianca Jagg. I had all these famous people that actually took my aerobics classes. And so it was a moment in time, something I'm pretty proud of actually.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. So, yeah. So you left that glorified environment and then stood on a stage and put yourself out there, told jokes.
Well, I actually was so well known. And back then, you know, today everybody's everything. Everyone's a singer, dancer, videographer, writer, you know, everyone's everything. But back in that day, when you came up and entertained, you were an actor or you were a writer or you were. So I was, again, well known with the fitness, which nowadays having success in one arena helps you cross over to another. But I actually ended up moving to LA because I wanted to put this aside actually and move to LA. I had this kind of, you know, burning desire to go there and get in entertainment. And I wanted to drop this and, you know, wait tables, be a cater waiter where I could just not think, go to a job. And then all my time off work was focused on acting and what have you. And it was through that where I was, you know, waiting tables and that my mind was always going. So I had always had menus or napkins in my pocket and I started writing because my mind was so quick. And that's when I actually really early out of the gate started writing my own shows. And I got slammed by the press because I did produce, write, direct, create the set, did everything for my own shows. And no one did that at the time. Oh. It was through that in my performing and shows and studying that my teachers pulled me aside and were like, you need to be doing comedy. Like you can do drama, you can do everything. But all my teachers were constantly giving me comedy. Oh, and I was like trying so hard to be this, you know, serious, dramatic actress. And they're like, yeah, you can do that. But this is your thing. So
did you go to places like the Laugh Factory and the, what are the other comedy clubs that are?
The Improv, the Laugh Factory, and I'm drawing a blank. The other one on right down the street from the, I could walk to the Laugh Factory. The comedy store. Yep. And the Ice House. So I prefer all of them in LA.
Oh, wow. Really? And were you sort of a regular feature there? Or was it sort of once a week or once a month that you would show up?
Well, I started, again, I was acting, got into improv comedy, started doing shows. Before I did stand up, I was a playwright, wrote my own shows, and really ahead of its time. We're going back, you know, 20 years where I was writing, I was a feminist playwright and writing shows called It's a Man's World, a two-woman show, Barbie dolls, things that were very provocative, pushing the envelope, and got me into meeting with a lot of female celebrities because they were just having production companies and kind of the word got out like, oh, wow, we heard about you. And so I met with Meg Ryan and Demi Moore and Gina Davis and Halle Berry and, you know, every female in town. And they're like, we don't know what to do with you. But in today's world, everybody has a production company and there's a bazillion different outlets besides just the three networks, HBO and Showtime. So I think it would be very different today. Whereas at the time it was like, I was told you write the way women speak, but most women write the way they think men think women speak. So that's why I got a lot of attention. And, but I think I was a little ahead of my time, to be honest. So I kind of got, I called it dying of enthusiasm, where I came very close to getting a production deal or a TV deal or a film deal. And then I decided to pack it up and go back to New York. And what I call New York is a process town and LA is a results town. So I went back to New York to study and just get like, my mantra was, I want to be so good, I can't be denied. Mm-hmm. I went back and started studying. And when I went back, I stopped and did a film in Boston with a bunch of comics. And that's kind of how I fell into the stand-up. A lot of guys were like, hey, you know, we're going to the club, we'll get you up. And I'd done stand up like 5 times and never took it seriously. And like the 6th or 7th time I did it was with them in Boston. And it was the first time I died on stage where it was just, and that's what made me, as I got hooked and that was it. So I moved to New York shortly thereafter, and then the routine in New York is I was up every night, probably 2-3 times a night, all over town.
Wow.
So, yeah.
And so can one say that comedy has genre like you would have of music? Is there a particular genre of comedy that you practiced, or did you just sort of find your audience and tell jokes or pound it to them to make them up? Yeah?
There's so many genres. Absolutely. Comparing it to music is absolutely right. There's people that are character comedians which is very big in the UK. You'll see people, Al Mary, the pub landlord, you would see someone play a character. Yes. In the UK. Then you have Richard Pryor, which I would probably, not that I'm Richard Pryor, but liken myself to that style. He was raw, real, told stories that were from his life, you know, honest, true. He also was very physical. I was very physical. So kind of all my acting and whatnot, I brought to the stage that I played a lot of characters. Maybe John Leguizamo is a little bit of someone I liken myself to. Eddie Izzard is a little bit out there with some wit. Yeah. So some people would make Eddie, again, I bow down to the altar of all three of these, but I think I brought a little bit of each of them to my work.
Oh, wow. That's a melting pot of characters. I find Eddie Izzard fascinating. I find him a little bit intimidating, but I also find his humor just touches me.
Yeah, because it's silly, but so layered with a lot of seriousness underneath it. So
yeah, what a deep guy. I mean, he went to Africa and ran multiple marathons to raise funds for humanitarian efforts and conservation, didn't he?
He did. I think he ran like a marathon every day.
Yeah.
For like a month or something.
And that's really not funny.
Yeah. No. I got wasted when I had a bar with him. It was like a dream come true.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So there's an interesting thing. When two comedians get together, I mean, you're not trying to out-joke each other in your conversation. You're just like two normal people having a conversation. Does it tend to be funny? Do you find you feed off each other and start, you know, getting ripped and falling off your bar stools, having a funny time? Or is it just like a regular experience?
Both. It depends on who the comic is. You know, some people are, some people you just have a great banter and you do boom, 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 and you're riffing. Other people are funny on stage, but they're very cerebral and they're writing, they're just a little bit more low key off stage. So it really depends on the person and also your dynamic with them. So but there is a community. I'd say it's like a fraternity that, I don't ever feel like I'm not a comedian. I don't feel like I'm not on stage every night like I used to be, but I feel like I'm still in it. Like my dad was a Marine and once a Marine, always a Marine. I may get so drunk, I fall down, but by God, I'll crawl like a Marine. And I stand up. It's like, I'm the Marine in me. Like I'm the stand up in me will never leave.
Mm. I witnessed an experience some years ago. I had two guys on safari with me. We were doing a project for National Geographic, and I had a whole lot of kids and their parents and media people following the trip to South Africa. That in itself was a whole lot of fun. But there were these two media guys, and they worked obviously for different outlets. One of them was a news anchor for, and I honestly forget the television stations, maybe ABC or NBC or XYZ, I don't know. His name was Lester Holt. And
NBC.
The other fellow,
NBC.
Was he NBC at the time? Yeah, a great guy, I mean, wow. And such a professional. And the other fellow was Boyd Matson, who was he was more of a sort of National Geographic, but he had also been news host and various other things in his career. And we did some filming together. We're filming these two guys together, sort of commentating on the kids' trip and what the safari experience was all about. And what I found absolutely fascinating was how they could pull things together in an unscripted fashion and just feed off each other, and so professionally and without, you know, we had entertained other film crews and there was always this, you know, film this and then refilm it and refilm it and refilm it. But these two guys just were so professional and bang, 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 bang. They worked off each other. It was just a really beautiful interaction to watch and witness.
Ah, I like to hear that.
Yeah, well, it was pretty good. Then, and on the other hand, I have a good friend up in British Columbia in Canada who goes by the name of Johnny Bagpipes. And, you know, I don't think I ever really got to know who Johnny Johnston was, which is the man behind the character Johnny Bagpipes. And Johnny Bagpipes is a fascinating story. Is this youngster who sees a bagpipe being played and then has this yearning to become a rock and roll bagpipe playing star. And so that is kind of the background to his stage persona. And obviously every time he goes up there and does his comedy act, it's interrupted by or punctuated with a variety of rock and roll bagpipes being played or sounds that are mimicked with the bagpipe. But I always felt when I was in his company that he was this character. He wasn't ever himself. You never really got to know who Johnny Johnston was. It was always Johnny Bagpipes that you're interacting with. And all the lines, all the conversations you had were sort of these, it was like a build-up to his line where he was almost testing you as the audience to see if he could get a rise, a reaction, a laugh, a smile. So you weren't one of those.
No, and there are people that I think never turn off or never, like, it's funny, when I toured a lot in Asia, as you know, I was a comedian for 10 years, so 4 years in the U.S., New York, 1 year, no, sorry, 3 years in New York, and then 1 year in L.A., and I didn't like the L.A. comedy scene when I went back at all. New York was awesome. I came up with Dave Chappelle and Dave Attell and Ben Bailey from Cash Cab and Judah Friedlander from 30 Rock, and, you know, it was this vibrant scene. It was competitive, but you weren't competing with other people. It was just, you were competing to get ahead and do well, but it was just this awesome, you know, tons of rooms. There were a lot of clubs, a lot of comedy rooms. It was just a great scene and great people, Rich Voss, you know, funny, funny people. And so when I moved to LA, I found it to be so competitive and backstabby and not supportive. And if you were on stage, there'd be TV people in the front row, like writing down your lines. And you're like, holy shit, that's going to end up on some show. It's like, you know, you're giving your bits away. And I wasn't feeling it at all. So I actually put a feeler out there to a guy that at the time was in the UK. And he said, hey, if you ever come over here, I think you would do really well. And I decided to take some time off. And that's how actually how the travel and comedy, that's how I got into travel, funny enough, was happened together. My sister said, why don't you just, you know, take off? You've never really traveled that much out of the country. Go to Europe, you know. So I booked a trip by myself for a month to go to London, Paris, and Edinburgh to the festival, because I performed there years ago as a playwright performer. And so I dropped a line to an email to this guy and said, hey, you know, I'm coming over. And before I got on the plane, he had me booked on my first international tour in the Middle East. So 20 years ago, when, you know, Dubai was in its baby stages, yeah. I was going to Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Bahrain, and I went to London and did this whole trip first. And I ended up becoming friends with Craig Ferguson's sister, Lynn, who was Scottish. And I was at the Edinburgh Festival, and she kind of took me under her wing. And I just kind of, she and I ended up doing a lot of touring around the UK together. We thought we were the same person with a different accent. My hair was to my waist. She had really short hair. She was really Scottish. I was LA. And so I ended up spending the better part of a year in London over there. And my teacher director at the time was doing a play in London, and she got a Fox Fellowship, and I was over there, and I ended up auditioning and got the lead for this play in London. And so I ended up spending a good year over there and loved it. And then from that point and through all that work, I did the Middle East, and then I started entertaining the troops in Korea. And so this whole international thing kicked off for me. I got invited to be the only female in the Singapore Festival. And so that's how the whole international and travel. And from that point forward, I've always traveled.
So I know you're modest, and I'm asking you questions to try and extract Karen Loftus from all the other stuff. And I have to make an observation here. For you to go over as an American and tell jokes in England in my opinion, is a huge act, because you're talking about people who, I mean, they the mother of the English language, right? So they speak it differently. It has different meaning to them. And so to be able to embrace their understanding of your joke and make them laugh, that takes intellect and a whole lot of... Yeah, exactly. And I would like to add, humor and alcohol sort of go together. You know, if you can get people a little bit loosened up with a vodka or two or a tequila or a beer or three, they're far more likely to laugh when prompted, as opposed to a sticky crowd that is not really shickered up, right? So, that must have been a huge challenge in the UAE, where 20 years ago, alcohol wasn't, and I don't know if it is available today, but I know in bars and things, there were no bars. You couldn't go and buy a drink publicly.
You could drink it at a hotel. You could only drink it in residence. You couldn't go to a standalone bar, but you could drink at a hotel.
So were you doing your gigs in a hotel environment, in a lounge?
I was. So like Century Plaza. Also, I performed at the Dubai Country Club, which I think closed a few years ago. But so I started in Bahrain, and that was kind of my niche that I ended up performing internationally, Middle East, Asia, Southeast Asia, Europe, and performed to a lot of expat communities. So you got kind of savvy local. The locals were pretty international and savvy and up market, you know, kind of people that traveled. We were spoiled because now everyone's media is all over the world, but still American media is pretty prevalent everywhere. So they knew our references or colloquialisms more so than, say, we knew theirs. So it didn't mean I could show up and act like I'm in LA doing a show. You had to still bring in a sense of the colloquialisms. Like I would always arrive to a place at least a day, preferably 2 days in advance, to pick up on nuances, because I got up on stage and I just went right into my thing. There's a weird dynamic in stand-up. It's like people feel like, does she know who I am? Like, does she know where she is? So if you don't address them, so I would do the first few minutes of little riffs and bits of my observations or little quirks. And then they're like, oh my God, she gets us. Like, we went to high school together. Like, boom, then you can go off and do your thing. So there was that, but there were sometimes, you know, you're speaking English, but things are lost, you know, pram, fanny pack, you know, all these little things yes. that are, you know, you had to adjust or your joke went dead. So it was not easy. You had to work harder, and probably what would happen today is what happened then. It was during the Bush era and people hated Americans. So it was not easy going over, because it wasn't like, oh my God, she's here. It was more of, you know, it was very odd to be, I was the first female in many countries to perform comedy that I performed in. So I was, if not the first, one of the first, second or third, very, it wasn't prevalent. It was a big deal. It was hard to be a female in a lineup, because there was a sense of groan, like, oh, you know, a woman's here. But the last 4 years of my six international, I toured on my own with a concert. So that was different, because then I became more known and people came out to see me. So they're invested in you being funny versus them showing up and seeing a woman at the tail end of an act. So that was more, like, hey, we're here to see you. And they want you to be funny. So, but you still, my show was called American Woman, a one woman comedic invasion. So my moniker around the world was, the press called me the American Woman. The American Woman is in town. So everyone called me that in the press. And so I took it on. So
yeah, they're giving you the publicity, embrace it for sure. That sounds great.
So it wasn't easy, but it was, my regret today is, you know, we all have phones and cameras in our pockets. I really wish I did a documentary of that experience, because the world was so different. And like looking back, I actually don't even know how I did it, traveling by myself around the world like that.
Yeah. So I'm interested to know that experience actually enticed you to set up a travel business, because when you're traveling like that, it sounds like you're kind of going from one commitment to another, there doesn't really seem to be a lot of opportunity to immerse yourself in the culture of the destination that you're in. Or was it because you were observing people that you were picking up on their nuances and being intrigued by the nationalities and the personalities of the different countries that you were entering that fired up your interest in traveling further?
Totally the latter. I mean, actually, it was more slow travel than you would imagine. I think when I go on, you know, as a travel writer, you go on press trips, you're like, boom, 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 boom. It's fast travel, speed dating. But back then, I would be brought over to Amsterdam to do a tour of the Netherlands, but they'd set me up in a flat for 4 to 6 weeks, and I would live there. And then all I had to do was at night get picked up by a driver, and we would drive to Rotterdam or The Hague, or, you know, I'd be in a different city every night. So I'd experience this great city and perform, and I get off stage and I'm partying and meeting people and having a ball, but I had all day to hang in Amsterdam and explore and, you know, find out about the place. Or when I was in Korea by myself for, I think it was 6 weeks, and same thing. I'm in a hotel in Seoul and I had the whole day to fill myself. So I was out and traveling and exploring, and then I would perform at night. So, yeah, it totally intrigued me. And again, 20 years ago, people didn't travel as much then that they do now. So it was really provocative and exciting. And being a woman by myself traveling around the world, I got picked up to go to a show. But other than that, no one really looked after me. So I figured a lot out on my own. And so when I took a break after performing for 10 years and I ended up back in LA and someone asked me if I wanted to work on the red carpet to interview celebrities, I just kind of did it as a gig to figure out, do I want to move back to Europe? What do I want to do? And it was through that that someone asked me, do I want to go on a press trip? So I never fancied myself a journalist. I was a playwright. I was a comedian. I'm a storyteller, but journalist? Nah. But I fell into it. And then I was sent on a press trip and suddenly I'm on a very fancy trip and now I'm traveling the world. And that was so easy to me in comparison to being a comedian. It was a fraction of the money that I made, but yet I was on a trip that was 10 times, you know, super expensive, fabulous trips. You looked after. And my moniker was, I still travel the world and tell stories, but I now put on the page what I once put on stage. So I still was
nice.
The world. Observing and so it was a totally, I really saw the world in two very different ways. But
you're fascinating, and I keep listening to you and you say things and I think, oh, I've got to pull you back on that one, I've got to pull you back on that one. But I really do. You said to document the red carpet, you called into the red carpet. Is that in Hollywood terms what it is all about when you involved with celebrity interviews? I've never heard that before.
So the red carpet is, the red carpet for award shows. I was out every night on the red carpet interviewing for a premiere, movie premiere, TV premieres, fashion shows. I covered everything. Grammys, Emmys, Oscar. I was there when Kanye's first time at the Grammys and Chris Brown's first time, you know. It was pretty amazing.
So how do you as a journalist extract the story out of those guys where you've got sort of 30 seconds and there's all sorts of other media around, the people around and other celebrities around? How do you get the story out of them? It must almost be impossible.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're not doing the deep dive, great one-on-one interview. It is quick, bitey, snap, bing, bam, boom. And I think being someone who's a little bit deeper and more of an artist, I interviewed a lot of writers as well, like the Hollywood, you know, people that were nominated for best scriptwriter. And I'd ask questions and they'd be like, where are you from? Like, who are you writing for? Because I would ask something much deeper and really quickly and get their attention. And then they would end up having a great conversation with me. So for me, I just wanted to just always have a great conversation. And if I went from that place versus what are you wearing, who's your girlfriend, how did you lose weight, you know, stuff like that, or, you know, silly stuff. And sometimes you're prompted, their PR people or the magazine will want you to ask stuff that was stupid and you would have to do it. But I would make sure I to feed my own soul, I ask my own questions as well. So I think a good conversation is a good lead into anything.
Yeah, it is. But challenging to be on that stage. Okay. That's all I wanted to hear about the red carpet, really. Not that I'm not disinterested. I'm not curious about you taking your pen and camera and traveling the world as a travel writer. I've always been envious of people in that job because it looks like so much fun, particularly from my end of the business where we're hosting you. And
yes,
I suppose every hotel, every operator, service provider, safari operator, guide, who knows that potentially there's some publicity that they can get out of your visit, puts everything that's the best of in front of you to make sure that whatever you touch, feel, is of the greatest quality and the finest delight. So it can only be fun. What would your most exciting destination have been? And I'm talking as a travel writer back in the day, not necessarily your women's adventure travels right now.
Oh yeah. Well, funny enough, it will seem like I'm pandering to you, Mr. South Africa and Mr. African travel, but I have to say I've been to Africa many times, but I'm sure you know John Pence from Aardvark Safaris. Yes. So John and I connected, I don't remember how now, and I have a great memory, so it's weird I don't remember, but I had done a bit of, you know, African travel, and somehow we got connected, and he said, you've done too much posh travel. You need to do real African travel. And so I had just done a fabulous trip to, you know, Tanzania. I was with Singida. Of course, it was, you know, a gorgeous trip, unbelievable, amazing. But I was with a lot of travel writers, of course, and it was a lot of writers from New York. And I'll never forget, we were in a Jeep and there was a lion literally like 4 feet below me. And there were a bunch of editors in front of me and they were talking about pitches and this and that. And I was like, never been on safari. And I just couldn't believe that we were in a Jeep with a lion. Literally, I could almost hit him. And people were talking, because my favorite thing on safari is to listen to the safari silence. And then they were talking about, like, I might as well be in New York. You know, we're talking about editors and pitching. We're talking about real world when you're supposed to leave that. And I made a commitment in that moment. I said, I'm coming back. I want to go back to Africa by myself for a month and really be in Africa. And the only way to be somewhere is to be by yourself, because then the whole destination rolls over you versus you being with people. Then it's influenced by. So I somehow got connected to John and we put together a trip, and I started, of course, high end with N Beyond in Botswana, which was in Okavango Delta. So we started with, you know, land on a lovely cloud of fabulousness, and I did. And then he coerced me to travel with Lataka to do the moving, the camping safari. And I did that for 9 days. And then I went on and did, I was there for 2 weeks, pretty much all told, in Botswana. And then I did 2 weeks in Namibia with Wilderness. So that trip, and probably the trip prior, a year, I went to Zambia. I think those two were my two favorite. I think Africa is just, you know, it's like none other.
Look, I do agree with you. Obviously, I'm a child of the African continent, so I have this thing in my blood that you just simply can't get rid of. But I do feel that it's just one of those continents where you are outdoors, it's raw, the people are so warm and welcoming and gracious in many ways. It just gets under your skin. And, you know, you made that comment about sitting next to a lion and people talking about stuff back home. And that, for me as a guide, used to really piss me off, because every day that I would go out, the wildlife and the wilderness would be different. There would never be one day where everything was the same. Yeah, the sun came up and it went down and the moon rose, and sometimes it was a sliver and sometimes it was full, and maybe one day there was rain. And yeah, those aspects changed, obviously. But the interaction between the creatures that you were seeing, if you just paused for a moment and drank it in, you would see things that you just would never expect to see. And I'll never forget you having a group of, in fact, they were journalists that we were hosting from South Africa Tourism, and a similar experience to you, but we had found these two male lions that had just recently finished eating a giraffe. Now, I mean, a giraffe is like, what, 1,500 kilograms of meat and bone. And for two male lions to consume a giraffe is an enormous amount of meat. And they did it in about 24 hours, maybe 36 hours. I mean, call me a liar for a couple of hours. But their bellies were so distended that these guys literally could not roll over. They were just lying there digesting their food. And when a lion digests food, its breathing rate accelerates. And so they're panting and panting and panting. But because they've just fed on this carcass, their breath stinks. It's vile. And not only that, they are so fat and distended that they literally are hardly able to get up and defecate. So they would rise up, take two paces, let it all go, and then collapse back down virtually in the... Yeah, no, no. So it's a disgusting story. But the thing is, the smell was overwhelming and nobody commented on it. To me, that was a dimension of Africa that was so in your face, and yet it was completely overlooked by these people who were more interested in the fact that they had seen Simba, the big Lion King, and lying there so sedately. It was, I don't know, it's just one of those bush moments that as a ranger you go, people, you know, shake your head, let your ears slap you around the cheeks and wake you up. I mean, come on, this is this is a fascinating place.
Like, be here, be... One of the people on the trip was a guy, and he and I bonded hard on that trip. We've been friends since. And he said something on that trip, which I've taken with me on every African trip since, that Africa is the great reset. So no matter where you are in your life, it just recalibrates. It reset. Like, you can't be the same person that you were when you got on the plane to go there. You're a completely different person when you get on the plane to come home. It just does something to you. And you're right there. It's funny, I've been with my team, like I mentioned to you, I'm dealing with video and all this stuff. Because I'm unearthing every shred of photos and video, I came across stuff I forgot I even had. And I have this amazing footage that I'm in the kitchen with the full staff, like dancing, singing. Like, no one ever said goodbye to me in Africa. It was a ritual. It was dancing. And the dancing led to like this improv that we would just go somewhere. Like, where does that happen? Where you're hugging and there's so much joy. And I was showing my sister a weekend ago and she had tears rolling down her face. She said, this makes me so happy and so sad that like we can't even hug people today. And to see this much joy hugging that, and in Africa, it's real. It's when people are that joyful, it's not played on, you know, it's raw and it's real.
No, it's not contrived at all. You might get the feeling that it's contrived and that managers have created this environment where staff must club together and clap and sing as you depart. It's not. There probably are some resorts that do that on a routine basis where it's not as, what's the word when you just simply do something quickly, off the cuff, but...
I know what you mean. Some properties, and there's that where they do the ritual and for some reason I was given an African name, which I love. And one of my favorite is Lerato. And so that was all caught on the camera and with the Ebb and Beyond crew, and Lerato meant love, and the different tribes fought over who was going to give me the name. And so it's this great story of them. And we did end up kind of hugging, and it was an organic song that came out and we all just started. So it wasn't a routine. It was like, we were in it together and it was just laughing. And in Namibia with the wilderness group, they do that whole song and dance, but I was in the kitchen with them. It's like, literally, my sister and I were laughing. There's like stacks of mayonnaise and spice behind me. And we are all gathered, the entire staff, and we are just laughing and hugging. And there was this whole, people went one by one down the line in like the kitchen. It's like the most random, amazing thing. So I'm going to do something with these videos. I don't know if I want to call it like the big goodbye, the long goodbye, the they're just so fun.
Yeah, the goodbye, it's like a lullaby. Maybe that's what it is. I took some friends from this area that I live in, which is known as the Northern Neck. It's a unknown haven in Virginia on the Chesapeake Bay. And we've got a a couple of good friends down here who came on a Zambian trip with us 2 years ago now. Wow. And we would have got back at the end of June. We had a fabulous time. And one of the things that really just stunned them was the beauty of the singing and how in tune and harmonious the singing would be. And every camp that we stayed at, you know, we bonded so well with the staff that we almost didn't want to pull out of the driveway to move on to the next stop, because the staff were, you know, they were just standing around and then breaking out into song and dance and waving and weaving, and so gorgeous. Anyway, Andy Hogg, who runs the Bush Camp Company, which is one of the places that we spend most of our time with him, recognized that he had this incredibly talented staff, and they now sing for a choir, and they've become known as the Mfui Choir, and they have gigs and do all sorts of great stuff just because of their natural talent. Yeah, amazing.
Wow. I love that. I have, I'm sure you've stayed at Tongabezi, and the school that Vanessa started, Tijane, something like that. There is, when we arrived to go to that school, the kids had prepared this welcome. It is stunning. They're like in, I don't know, third, fourth grade, but it's beautiful. And like you said, in tune, harmonious. So I have one of my girls where I didn't even realize I had footage, because the footage, you know, I had a flip camera back then. I mean, it was not hidden. But we're doing a video, and it opens with that song, just bleeds into the opening of the video, because it's literally being welcomed into the country. That was the last thing that happened. The last place I went, we actually put it in the beginning, because it's just like, that's Zambia. You're welcome, and you hear it, you feel it, it's in your bones.
Yeah, Zambia for me. In fact, I'm busy doing a podcast at the moment. It's a two-part podcast on searching for a guy whose name's Gavin Johnson. And he's up the Zambezi River, and I go looking for him. This is way back. But anyway, the Zambia is a fascinating and a beautiful country. You spoke of Tongabezi. I go, or have represented, a place a little bit further upstream called Islands of Ziankaba. And essentially, this little lodge environment exists to support the village of Ziankaba. I took my friends to that spot as well. And we went in to meet the chief and the members of the village. And obviously the school is a very proud place, because that kind of shows where the money from tourism is going. It's something that they wouldn't have had in the past, proper school structures with blackboards, books to read, pens and papers, all that good stuff that we take for granted over here, which a little African village just doesn't have access to. Normally schools would be held under the shade of a fig tree or something. So one of the visits was to the school, and yeah, like your experience, these kids sang for us, and they sang songs about their country. And I have this little video clip where they kind of swaying in time to their song. And one little guy obviously sings out of time, and the girl in front of him just turns around and swats him across the face. It's like, get it right, dude. And then these little dinky people, just little guys. It was just a brilliant experience. Yeah?
Ugh, the kids kill me. They're just so fat. Ugh.
Yeah, but okay. So Women's Adventure Travels, one of its pillars is immersing itself or your travelers in culture. That can be a very canned experience. I mean, I think of outside Gorongoro Crater in Tanzania, where as you descend the outer wall of the crater on your way into the southern Serengeti or the Ndutu Conservation Area, there's a massive Maasai Manyata, which, I mean, kudos to the chief of that little area, because he's turned it into a great commercial operation. And every sort of minivan that goes past that way is flagged and stopped and pulled into the Manyata, where the Maasai will dance and sing and clap and show you around their village and collect some money and then let you go. To me, that's become the anti-cultural experience, because it's really just good old-fashioned commercialism. So how are you getting people into the culture without being offensive and without making that experience a sort of a commercial entity of your trip?
Well, I think it's knowing people like you and the people that you know, that it is doing the deeper dive and not, and doing avoiding what you just explained by all costs. I don't want to do anything that feels like everyone is doing it. You don't want to feel like you're commercializing or doing, as a comedian, we would call that hacky. You know, like it's hacky, it's cheap. And it's in tourism as well. And you're explaining that is exactly that. It's not real, it's not authentic. So I definitely put together and working with my relationships with people that I know from having been there and my relationships, you know, going deeper and further to meet the local people. And it might be a school, but you know, you have an authentic experience or you have tea in someone's home with the women and you hear about what it's really like to be a woman in that village. Or you do the little shopping or what have you. And some are a little commercial and sometimes you feel like, well, maybe I'm supporting the local community. So I think it's just, it takes work and time and the relationships come from either having been there and or having knowing people that to really unearth those special people and those special things that I think that's what I pride myself in is I have great relationships and whether I'm putting together a virtual speaker series for my interns or going on a trip, I know people all over the world. When I meet people, I go deep and that's why I hug and dance in a linen closet practically and, you know, make friends. And so I think I take that with me wherever I go. And I really made it a point that I didn't plug and play any of these trips and that they are all with that extra character and care and, you know, working with, as you know, I worked with your peeps for the South Africa one and my gosh, I felt so bad. We went back a zillion times because it does have to be special. It has to be, we're on the beach and we're eating at this special restaurant and I don't want to do things that everyone's doing and we turn left and we go here and we're on a boat and, you know, all those special, it's more time and a lot more effort for everybody, for them, for me. But obviously it's the experience I want to have. And so I always lead with that. And that's, I kind of plan travel in the way I want to travel.
Yeah, and I think you, in terms of the, if I can call it the travel recipe in curating an itinerary for clients, I think you're on the money. I'm getting the sense that travelers don't want to feel like they are tourists.
They want to
feel as though they're traveling on their own, sampling and experiencing, immersing along the way, even though they might be part of, I don't even want to use the word group, but it's a contingent of other people. You actually mentioned something a little earlier on about traveling on your own, and it made me think about when I actually in 1993 took off for about 8 weeks and backpacked across South America from Rio to Chile, and I did it on my own, and I loved it. I mean, the entire trip was just a wonderful experience. I met so many fascinating people along the way, even though I couldn't speak Portuguese or Spanish. We kind of figured things out as I moved along. But what I came back on that aeroplane thinking about was the highs and how that experience was just so uplifting in every way. But then I also thought about the lows and how they were extreme, you know, and for me, that was the essence of solo travel is you have these extreme highs and extreme lows and they really balance each other out. You can't have either without the other. And it's fascinating.
I agree. And I think therein lies, again, potential for growth. Like you really know who you are if you put yourself somewhere you've never been with people you've never met. So if you take along with you a spouse, a parent, a child, a friend, a teacher, a comrade, you're seeing a place with that history. You bring that with you. When you are dropped and you are taken at face value, which is, again, all my things are interconnected. Like as a comedian, I went around the world because not only was I want something different than LA. I wanted, like my mantra remained, I want to be so good I can't be denied. Well, I know people in LA, I know people in New York. So when I went around the world and I dropped down, I didn't know anybody and no one knew me. And like you said, it was so hard. People had, you know, issues about American and women. But if I could be funny in that room, my shit was funny. I loved that challenge. And similarly, I love the challenge and the travel that, yeah, at times it was hard and it was, I mean, it was grueling and really difficult and hard as a comedian and as a traveler in both ways, for different reasons and different ways. But I really, really knew who I was. And you learn who you are by interacting with people and figuring stuff out. You learn a lot about yourself. You feel empowered. I just think it's the best thing. And even when it's hard, the other side of it is like, wow, you're just a different person.
Yeah, and that's another aspect, another one of your pillars of your trips is empowerment. And
yep.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that empowerment, because my question really is, who are you empowering? Are you empowering your traveler? Are you empowering the people that your traveler is meeting? Or is it a combination? I guess it's a combination.
It is. Yeah. Like I always say, you know, and therein lies, I think, the idea of immersive versus, oh, we're going to, you know, run by and wave and we're so different because we were there. That's a flyby. To me, I call Women's Adventure Travels the deep dive tribe. The deep dive is that, you know, I say we inspire women to empower themselves and those around them through travel. So by virtue of going on a trip, whether you're with a girlfriend, by yourself, it's empowering to go somewhere you haven't been or do an adventure. You and I are both into adventure travel. So even the physicality of it all, doing, you know, a hike you've never done or, you know, kayaking up some crazy river, just physical things, when you overcome these fears or you didn't know you had the physical or, you know, what have you, that's self-empowerment. You feel great. Or you put yourself in a social circle. You didn't know you could end up in this, you know, African village by yourself and then make friends. That's empowering. But what I call this, it's not a dartboard, it's tennis, in that when I go somewhere, I'm changing, but because I was there, they changed. So I call that the exchange of change in travel. Yeah. No two things can ever be the same. I'm different and they're different based on this what happened. So if you're having this great authentic experience, yeah, they're going to learn something or be different because of me and I them. So I think the empowerment comes, it's not like, oh, we're trying to save people in Africa. It's that maybe it was in, you know, in this circle of story, we do stories around the fire, or we meet with the women or they meet with us, that there is a sense of empowerment of us, you know, meeting and gathering women. And I have a thread through many of the trips where we highlight women owned and operated businesses. So we are showing women on the trip, which they will feel inspired and potentially empowered to maybe do the same by seeing women defying the odds locally, whether it be in a small village or globally, that they're a top architecture in, you know, if we're in Chile versus somewhere else. And so there is a thread of empowerment that you find, you experience, you witness, and hopefully take with you.
Yeah, that is terrific. I have worked with, I mean, you know, Peru. I think I've introduced you to my colleagues at Aurora Travel, my aunt and Anna, over in Vietnam.
Yep.
But I'm continually inspired by these ladies for what they can achieve and what they do and the networks that they have. They're just fascinating women, really powerful women. Some good stuff.
She's been amazing. She's been very, very good to me. So I mean, there's, you know, I was working on that TV show and still hope to do it. That's, you know, shelved at the moment because we can't go anywhere. But so that's really the whole idea for the TV show, is being pumped into the podcast potentially, as it will be that sense of interviewing, highlighting, featuring great women. And right now we're doing the podcast version, but the idea is that it will become 3D live and, you know, multicolor, technicolor, much more visceral when we actually are able to be these places and then shoot as well. So that's kind of the idea.
You got a lot going on. I thought I was doing well with the podcast.
You are. You've already done it. You're ahead of me.
I don't know. At least I hide my face. Mine's just an audio, you know. I haven't got the studio system worked out. I actually had a great idea. I was thinking, you know, the success of a podcast is really about the people that you talk to and the stories that they bring to the audience. And at some point, you know, you've got to get referrals from one person to another to be able to keep your storyline going. So I came up with this idea that I would buy two microphones, and the microphones obviously for sound quality. if you interview somebody, they're talking on a microphone, you're talking on a microphone, you eliminate the sort of ambient noise, etc. But that's a typical Joe Rogan setup where you've got this dude and he's got his, you know, guest in front of him, and there's a sound manager over there, and everything's very professional done, and the sound quality is really great. When I started my podcast, I was literally using the microphone of my computer, but I bought this new microphone. But my idea was to get two, and then when I interview somebody, I would actually mail the microphone to them with the instruction of, okay, you're talking to me on this particular subject and we'll go for it and have fun. Once we're done, you're not the owner of that microphone. You have a responsibility to pass it on to somebody else. And when they open the box from the FedEx guy or whoever it is that delivers it, there's a note inside it from me saying, I'm Warren Green from the Greenpeace podcast, and you've received this microphone because so-and-so, and insert your name here, recommended you to talk to me. Please test the microphone on your computer and then send me a text or email me so we can set up an interview date. And then that way I just interview this random person who might or might not be interesting, who knows, and then it continues. So that microphone then gets passed around the state, the county, the world, who knows?
Love that. Just
develop this really interesting collage of stories. And obviously we would use the brand of the microphone as the subtext. So it might be the pile conversation. Yeah. Yeah. So there's some ideas that I want to pursue as I go along with this thing.
I love that. I actually love the title too. I'm very into titles and logos, and I think the title's great. I mean, obviously it's your name, but also how interesting, you know, it works.
It does. And I made a mistake. I didn't research it first. And since I've claimed the name, I've Googled it, and the green P spelled P-I-E-C-E is all over the place. So I now have to insert the Greenpeace podcast to try and make it a little bit more unique. But you know, I thought I was being damn clever using P-I-E-C-E along with green, because, yeah, as you know, I mean, sustainability, sustainable practices, ecotourism, that's my vocabulary, man. I love that stuff.
Yeah. No, I love it. I think it works. And I love the double entendre and the play on it and your name. And so it works on many levels. So trademark it. Make sure you send in your, and the thing that helps you with the trademark is if you have a visual. So that name is common, like you said, it's common, obviously, because Greenpeace is well known as well. So the way you can hold on to something is that you send your visual with it as well. So then they'll trademark the watermark, in essence.
Well, I need to come over and be an intern in your little business environment and learn a few more tricks from you.
We'll get you to camp.
Why don't you just loan me your team for a week?
Oh, they would love that. Yeah, no, they're great. You'll see our video. It should be pretty fun, the group. We have all these little cute things that we do. We do a Bring Your Pet to Work Day. At the end of every Zoom, everyone brings their animals into the frame. And so it's a lot of cute stuff.
Yeah. Well, I need to borrow them. It sounds like you created a great environment there for everybody.
It is upbeat and positive and fat. And how about you? How many people are on your team?
Well, we've shrunk quite considerably over the last couple of months. And it's actually quite tragic, really, because up until the end of last year, early part of this year, I was actively looking for somebody who would be my understudy and help me with the travel workload. But I was looking for a person who shared my commitment to the sustainable practice, that it needed to be in their DNA. And I think I was getting close to on that search. I'd interviewed a handful of people. And then, you know, good old COVID came back and arrested those plans. So there's three of us at this stage, me, myself, and I, and we work really well together.
You should have interns, though. Everyone's told me that I should do like a seminar, really, of how, you know, everyone's like, oh my God, I want an intern. And they don't fall from the sky. It's like anything else. You have, it's having an eye and an ear and knowing the right people and and then the training and this and that. But I think it's a great way to go. And if you, it's an investment, nothing is free. So even if they are, you know, getting their credits or whatever, you're putting time and energy and investing and training and giving them something. But it would help someone like yourself, a sole proprietor, you're there. It's also just the camaraderie of actually bouncing your stuff around with someone and helping with the graphics, the creative, the marketing, you know, all that stuff. Because you can't, it's a lot. You can't. It's, I know, you know, in my many years when I was touring the world as a comedian, I was so busy because I was, you know, had this big show. And then I had a nonprofit at the time called Body Comedy. And I worked with, I use humor to heal. I worked with survivors of violence, women and girls. So home, that was my passion project. And that was my baby, a nonprofit. And I went into prisons and I worked with teen prostitutes, and Comedy Central was my sponsor at the time. And so that was my baby. And I were, you know, I was at the male prison and female prison back to back. Wednesdays was like flat out. And then I kind of bopped around. It was all volunteer and I got a little stipend from Comedy Central. And then I was touring all over the world. So I was doing booking. And when I would arrive in a country, I had a producer and they handled the PR and, you know, posters and all that kind of stuff and all soup to nuts. But it took a lot of work to get to the place where I was working with different producing partners all over the world and social media. And I was at a show. I was doing a show in LA and this woman was like, "You need interns." And I had never had an intern. I didn't even know how to get one or what. And I was like, "I'm just too busy. I can't be bothered." And so she said, so she was from the Ms. Foundation for Education. So she went and put a posting up for me on their board. And that was how I got my first intern, that all these girls from all over the country flew from all over the States and worked with me that summer. And one of the girls was one of my guests in this quarantine routine. This she was my first intern years ago. And I took her to Europe. I took her to prison. I took her to Europe. And then I never had an intern again until last summer. So
I'm not surprised you took her to prison. I mean, gosh, who's going to want to come back?
We were laughing because today, you know how safe everything is today. This university was like, you can't have anyone in your car. Like if you go for coffee, you know, all the paperwork you have to sign. And so no one's in my, like I spoke at this big conference and all the girls came out to see me in the fall, this big entrepreneurial conference. And it was so silly because I drove by myself. I couldn't have them in the car with me. And so we were laughing. I was telling her this story when I had all the interns and I said, you know, I can't take people in the car to go for coffee. And I said, I took you to prison in Europe. You know, like she was my intern because it was 20 years ago, completely different, or not even 20, 18 or so. Different world.
Yeah, very different world. And our world's changing so rapidly all the time. I mean, it really is. I can't believe how things have changed from 5 years ago, let alone 10 years and more.
2 months ago. But yeah. The point is, I'm happy to talk to you off pod.
Okay.
And encourage you to do so because it's, you know, it helps you. It helps that it's the exchange of change again.
Well, Lofty, I think let's leave it at that, and I will talk to you off the pod because you've got some great creative ideas, and you've inspired me a lot. This was a great conversation. It needed to be around that African campfire, right, where we could hear some owls calling in the distance, and a few nightjars, maybe a far off hyena whooping and a leopard call, maybe a lion roaring. That would have been ideal.
That would have been great. But we have to do that. We have to be on the same trip at some point, right?
I definitely think so. I think as you get going again and we're allowed to fly, there's the travel in Durban next year. We should try and get you out on that and come and explore some of the properties and camps that I represent, and I can join you for an evening around that campfire. We'll do a live podcast around the fire, changing logs every now and then.
Yeah, I love that, Warren. Well, you're a legend. Thank you so much for having me. I always have a big smile on my face when I see you at a conference or just hear you on the phone. And you're just your passion for Africa and your passion for travel and conservation is contagious, and you've been so generous to me with all your people, and I feel grateful to have you as a friend and an ally in this field.
No, the pleasure's been all mine, Lofty. Thank you so much for joining me. And by the way, just on that point of smiling when you see me at a trade show, I just have to describe when I last saw you at a trade show, I knew you were there. We hadn't connected, and I was walking down a very busy aisle. And then, I mean, for my audience out here who don't know what you look like, and I'm not one to describe people on my podcast, but I think it's appropriate. Karen's got a lot of white hair, blonde hair. She wears what do you call it? Lipstick that is a very bright red. And on that particular day, I think you might have been wearing a puffy white dress with polka dots and red shoes that were stiletto style. And we saw each other, and you gave a shriek and a laugh. And I mean, the trade show aisle that you were on came to a standstill for a brief second.
But the rest of the story sounds right.
The cameo moment to say goodbye on. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Warren. Thank
Catch you.
You
later. Bye. Oh, my God.